Good afternoon. I'm sitting here with Michael Stalker, and he's a part of my father's Seven Circles, and he's a part of any number of environmental programs that help the environment. And I'm not quite sure of all the accolades that that you have under your belt, or even a lot of the history, you know. But Michael and I have been talking for quite a while this morning, and then a little bit last night, about some of our spiritual beliefs and about what's going on in the world today in terms of the environment and community. And so we're just going to start talking with you. And we don't quite know where this is going, but we're going to find out. So good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks, Dan, for this opportunity to be a part of the fabric of your community here. And really honored to be here. I came up with Uncle Fred Wapapa to kind of support the Sundance up at Pilot Rock this this weekend. And I've been coming up here for quite a few years. This is an element of my life. For a living, I am a technologist. I work in physics and acoustics. I've been doing a lot of work in bioacoustics lately, which is specifically focused on how are we affecting the ocean with the noise that we are putting into it. The noise of industry, the noise of commercial enterprise, the noise of military. And it's increasing significantly in the ocean to the point where we're starting to see fallout. So the ocean is yet another place where humans' disattention to our connectedness, our relatedness to all those things around us is beginning to fray at the fabric of our own survival. So that's kind of what I'm working at. And of course, there's two ways of working on it in our society, which are seen kind of maybe diametrically opposed. One is the spiritual way, of course, to make sure that whatever happens, we're open to the possibilities, that we're right with Creator. And the other, of course, is the scientific way, which we're attempting to push the ways that we feel are necessary to make things work properly into those areas that we want to see them work. And I think there seems to be a fairly large skepticism developed between those two, that the people who are in the scientific realm oftentimes look at the people in the spiritual realm as being, you know, hopeful dreamers, or perhaps disconnected from the repeatability of Newtonian Cartesian science. And then those people who are in the spiritual realm are also oftentimes, I think, either fearful or certainly wary of the product of the scientific mind, because we see a lot of that as it's being revealed by our commerce, by industry, as being harmful to the planet.
So you're truly walking two worlds. You're involved in a sweat lodge and Sundance and Native American church, and yet you take a very heavy scientific approach and interpretation of all these things that are around you.
Well, I definitely am attempting to try to weave this larger fabric together. I don't see them necessarily as being diametrically opposed. In fact, as we are related to all things, we are also related to all ways those things are read and interpreted. So, as we were speaking a little earlier today, there's an imaginal place that we reside that's called the reality that we accept. We have to construct that somehow. Our belief systems do that. And that could be constructed any number of different ways, as we're seeing worldwide. There are people who are living in ways that we really have no way to comprehend, because their imaginal structures are very different than our own. But one of the things that came up to me a number of years ago, I met with some folks who were doing shamanic journey work around this issue of noise pollution in the ocean and how the military sonar was damaging the communication abilities of the whales. And the way where they were working on the issue was they were doing shamanic journeying with drums, and I came in really as a scientist, and I didn't see it initially a place for me to be there. But then I realized that there was, in fact, some way to equilibrate that. There was a correlation that the shamanic imagination and the scientific imagination have some very strong similarities. And that is, these imaginal forms take our minds where our bodies can't go. So what I started doing in this group of people who were working shamanically was to bring scientific data or scientific framings into the conversation, and allowing these people to inhabit really the imaginal world of the scientist. The beauty about that, and where that really kind of started unfolding, is because the power of their imaginal reality was so strong. They've been exercising those prayer muscles, if you will, so much that a lot of the scientists hadn't, that when they began inhabiting that, we were able to really get a lot done. And so a lot of my work from that point on really became, how do you engender or cultivate an imaginal sense that's not based on assumptions that are not necessarily, if you will, scientifically demonstrable, which requires repeatability, it requires having the null hypothesis to prove that something doesn't work, has to do with certain systematic ways of looking at things. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, except perhaps that some of those tools are fairly narrow. What we're looking for in repeatability is things that we can ascribe numbers to. Well, the emotions of ants, for example, or the emotions of, you know, the love of a duck for their ducklings is not necessarily something that is scientifically repeatable, but it's very obvious. So, you know, those are the types of things we need to weave into the fabric and not see them as opposed, but rather see them as opportunities to kind of roll back our own frontiers of understanding with. I don't know if that's very clear. It sounds pretty abstract, but part of what I've been attempting to do is looking at things like the opposition between the Navy, U.S. Navy, and environmentalism, and seeing it as an opportunity to to create common visions in terms of outcomes, or looking at commerce and seeing, well, is there a way we can take this commercial framing and create something that is helpful to the planet and helpful to commerce as well? There's people working on that type of stuff. Bill McKibben, for example, has got a really beautiful book called Deep Economy that talks about how we can reframe our economic assumptions. And the same thing with Paul Hawken. We can kind of reframe our economic assumptions and come up with something that works economically, but also works environmentally or ecologically. So,
and excuse me, we're on our back deck of my house, and dogs get kind of distracting. Well, the salmon, I believe personally, you know, bring that spirit of the ocean onto the land, you know, and there have been so many, you know, it's almost it seemed as if a long time ago a treaty was made between the ocean and the land. You know, if you want to get into a mythical story mindset, is that you would think the salmon would come up here and give their young to the land, even though they're in the river. You know, it's quite the jump to go from salt water to fresh water, and to me it seems to be like you're kind of paying a sacrifice for a prayer that's happening. You know, and so that's kind of my interpretation of the salmon, you know, coming up and to be putting all these dams, you know, in the river, you know, and to take advantage of its power, you know, for our own personal gain, you know, seems to be a number one petty, and number two, nefarious, even, you know. I mean, it was just ignorant, really, is what I really mean, you know, because the sheer amount of population that we're suffering under today, you know, is only made possible mainly by fossil fuels, you know, being here, and that we're taking the carbon dioxide out of the earth that's been stored there for generations, and which allows us to overburden the planet with our presence, you know. And so now we have to seek alternative fuel sources, you know, and so wind and solar, you know, that's all fine and all, but what are the costs of making these solar panels and the carbon dioxide that goes into the air and all these things? You know, it's just such a fine, tricky, narrow path that we're walking today. It's like we're walking through a minefield, you know. The economy is getting burdened down in such a way that we're seeing perhaps biblical, you know, interpretations of the future, you know. The ecology is being stressed to the point that many species are dying at an alarming rate. You know, it's been, what did you say, the sixth largest extinction?
Right, since that's the sixth global extinction, and it happens. So, you know, these cycles occur. And we are walking through a minefield, and it's a hair trigger minefield, which is a little frightening. One of the things that human beings can mediate, I mean, things happen in a continuous unfolding of time, and our participation in that has traditionally been one of tracking as it happens, as the salmon come up through the seasons, as the birds come down through the years, days of the years. Those things that we rely on year after year after year, the cycles, we've been able to mess with that. And fossil fuel is a good example of that, where we've been able to take millions and millions of years of the accumulation of solar energy and compress it into less than 100 years of our energetic use. And that's really speeded things up. It's compressed our sense of time. And it's got to a point now where time becomes the component that we feel we have such control over, that, you know, when this disaster happened a number of years ago and those towers fell down, that the very first thing that came out of our leader's mouth was not one of prayer or one of sacrality. It's keep shopping. Because our time is so compressed and we're so hair trigger that if we stop shopping, the whole house of cards would fall down. Which is actually a good thing to remember, because it gives us power if we think in those terms, if we want the house of cards to fall down. That being said, if we can stretch our cycles out a little bit more, not consume those millions and millions of years so fast, if we can look at kind of taking our time and tracking a little bit better with the seasons. You know, the idea of putting dams on a river and blocking the passage of the salmon is a very powerful metaphor to what we've done. I mean, these salmon have depended upon the melt of the snow and the inflorescence of the spring flies, and those things that happen. These animals have a life cycle of a few years, which they depend on to complete their cycle. And it's really clear in a healthy salmon situation where the salmon lay their eggs, and they're done at that point in time. They end up dying on the sides of the river and fertilizing the plants, and the river itself becomes actually abundant with foodstuffs, with that high nitrogen source that the salmon originally came from the river in the first place when they were feeding and getting big out in the ocean. So that cycle, those kind of these years that these salmon do this work, now that's an agreement that they have with Creator, and we participated in that agreement for a long time, you know, and taking the bones of that first salmon back to the ocean, transporting that carcass back there, was an acknowledgement that that cycle existed, that the ocean was part of what we were doing up in the mountains. And we've lost that when we started seeing salmon as product, and with salmon as pounds per dollar or pounds per cents or what have you. And we really thwarted that as we started putting those dams in, saying, well, what we need this power for is so we can, have things going on at night as well when the sun goes down, or have things go on faster so that we can harvest the wood and make the paper and write those paper, those reports and books and what have you. I mean, a lot of those, I'm not sure about the Klamath River, but I certainly know up in Washington State, a lot of those dams were put there to power paper mills so that they could grind up the forest to make paper. And, we're fairly disconnected from eating that first salmon and taking those bones and putting it back into the sea in that context.
Well, we're starting to, we've had a salmon ceremony for quite a few years now up here, and it's been an open, intertribal, open to the public, virtually, ceremony that Grandma Aggie has, Agnes Baker Pilgrim, the oldest surviving Siletz member, is Takelma, has really gotten back to the ceremony and is kind of receiving flack from her tribe because they made her take away the word sacred, you know, and it's kind of, and she models, you know, she remembers, you know, how they did it way back when is when you took the bones and the skin from the salmon and you put it back, and you put it back with some cedar and sing songs. And that's what that whole event is about, is recognizing the salmon and the relationship between the human beings. And there's a lot of stories being told. As long as we follow the salmon, that people will be healthy, you know. And if we walk away from the way of the salmon, then there will be war. So there's a lot of correlations up and down the coast of tribal recognition of the salmon and their contract that they made with the Creator.
It's an important one, particularly right now. I know that you're being affected up here in Oregon. I come from the Bay Area, and the coho salmon down there, there was only 65,000 count salmon, and they had to shut the salmon season down this year, first time ever. We have not paid attention to those agreements, and we have allowed other forces to come in and compromise the habitat. We've made some assumptions about commerce that did not square with our survival, the survival of the salmon. Well, the salmon nation includes all those rivers that flow into the North Pacific from both sides of the Bering Strait. And we have compromised that, certainly in our area on the coast, and I am pretty sure up here as well you guys are having problems with it. Where we had to shut our salmon season down. And what is the answer to that that the economists are seeking is aquaculture, salmon farming. I mean, this is another place where we're attempting to break that path, the cycle of the salmon, putting these animals in pens, and then we go out into the sea and we pull all the krill and the shrimp and whatever out of the water to feed the salmon. Well, the challenge with that is that we're now competing with the wild salmon for their foodstuff. We're competing with the whales for their foodstuff. And then when they take that krill out there, when the way that the salmon work in terms of their relationship with krill and other small animals in the ocean, it takes about 3 pounds of those small animals to turn into become 1 pound of salmon. When they take it out fishing-wise and they dry it out, it takes about 10 pounds to turn it into 1 pound of salmon. Well, that's not a very efficient use. What is efficient economically is they have these animals in pens so none get away. But what ends up happening is that agreement that we have, that fabric of the connectivity of time and the cycle of the salmon and the agreements that we have with the other animals are all being violated by that. So, you know, farmed salmon, for example, is another one of those places where humans are coming in with their quote-unquote better idea, and it's very rapidly compromising those larger cycles.
So we're going to have a Native Eco Symposium up here, and a centerpiece of our Native Eco Symposium is salmon. The whole Eco Symposium is about native foods and sustainable agriculture. So we're going to hopefully get Michael Stocker up here and listen to more of him as a public speaker here. But I'd like to switch the conversation now over to what you're currently working on and what you're doing with the noise levels in the ocean and so not completely understanding a lot of what's going on. I'm sure some of it's extremely low frequencies you've mentioned before, and but I'm sure there's different kinds of noise out there, such as pollution and different levels of noises and frequencies. And so what's going on with that?
Yeah, thanks for that opportunity here. I got involved in this. I come out of music and sound. My living has been made through acoustics and music, working in the music industry. About 15 years ago, I heard that there was going to be a communication system put in the ocean that was going to allow the military to talk between the coast of California and Hawaii. And they were talking about this in terms that were, they sounded technically benign, but understanding what was going on, it didn't sound like a good idea. And why was I concerned about that? Well, the ocean, for the animals who live in it, is not a visual environment. In the best of circumstances, visuality, you might be able to see 100 feet or a little bit more than that. But sound works fabulously in the ocean. So when it gets dark at night or when you get down below a few hundred feet where the sunlight doesn't penetrate, all the animals down there depend on sound to survive, to find their food, to connect with their community, to avoid predators, to generally establish their relationship with their surroundings. So I started realizing that 15 years ago, we were starting to put noise in the ocean, which was not something that the animals were habituated to. The noise levels in the ocean have increased, well, just due to shipping noise. The ocean is 10 times noisier than it was 40 years ago. Now, how does this work for the baleen whales, for the blue whales that need to communicate 2,000 miles to each other to establish their relationship or to use that sound of the ocean to navigate? Or how does that work for the humpback whales that have these beautiful songs that they need to sing, and they're trying to sing it in a noisy restaurant, if you will? And I started seeing also around 2000 some very catastrophic whale strandings that were a consequence of Navy communication sonar. So I came in as an acoustician, as somebody who understands physics and technology, and started working on this problem. We're starting to see an increase of noises, not just the noises of shipping and commerce, which was as a product of globalization, but also a lot of underwater communication systems that are used for exploration, for communicating with submarines, for military purposes. And we're also seeing, for example, in terms of oil and gas industry, well, they have to do explorations. They use these, they call seismic air guns, that they use to explore the earth underneath the water. And there's explosions that happen every 10, 15 seconds that are loud enough to be able to be heard 2,000 miles away in the ocean. Bang, 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 bang. And I've got some amazing recordings of whales attempting to sing through this. I've got recordings of this sound, these sounds, the sonar sounds, for example, that will just basically crack the enamel off your teeth. So what we're trying to do is to try to determine how to characterize these sounds. And I don't think the noise in the ocean is all necessarily bad. I mean, if you go 250 years ago, there was so much more life in the sea than there is now. I mean, we've pulled over 90% of the complex vertebrates out of the ocean in the past 150 years. The whaling industry, I mean, there were millions of humpback whales at one point in time, and they're gone now. And they're all singing. And that was loud. But the noise we're putting in the ocean now is different. So what I'm attempting to do is try to distinguish those differences and see if we can use that qualification or quantification of those differences to help craft the noises we use to be more akin to biological noises. Why am I doing it this way as opposed to saying stop the noise? Well, you can't tell the U.S. Navy to get out of the water. They're going to be there. Our civilization, as much as we want to try to slow things down or transform it into a spiritual construct, we are still dependent upon the commerce and the ways of harvesting both food out of the sea as well as off the lands to survive. And we're going to be noisy for a while. So if we can craft our noises, help understand that we are also part of it as opposed to just blundering ahead, we may be able to keep the ocean environment a little bit more of a sanctuary and less of a kind of a thrash house is what it's turning into now.
Well, I know that they're doing studies on whales and how the water flows across their fins. They're realizing that the bumps on, I think it's the blue whale, on his fins help actually propel the whale through the water by creating mini vortexes around its fins. And so they're working with aerodynamics and trying to recreate these bumps on the wings of planes and whatnot to actually help the plane to get better lift. So it's very much in terms of what you're talking about is coming in harmony with the biologicalness that's out there and to help us to help ourselves in terms of getting along with this earth.
Well, nature is a model that we need to follow. I mean, in terms of consistency, you know, if you talk about 30 million years ago, the whales and dolphins that we know were just beginning to come into the ocean. They were amphibious animals before that. We had the Amblycetus and some other critters that were, they're amphibious. They had feet. They came into the ocean and very rapidly evolved into the forms that we see today, and then they haven't really evolved significantly in terms of their physical structure. So they've adapted so perfectly to their environment that they have a need to change. There's lessons in that. From a hydrodynamic standpoint, we look at any of the natural ways of moving energy from place to place, of establishing flow forms, of growth patterns. There's a lot to learn there. And one of the reasons why we haven't really done that is because it's, in many cases, incomprehensibly complex. We know that when we pray, we're praying into the mystery. But in terms of science and repeatability, it's very difficult. You know, one of the assumptions that the Newtonian Cartesian science has been based on is that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. Well, if you look in nature, with very few exceptions, there are no straight lines. And even if you look at the straight line on the edge of a crystal, that's actually an intersection of a helical form of a crystal lattice structure inside that crystal. So one of the things I've been doing over the past few years is working with this company called PAX Scientific, and we've been looking at the way air and water flows and the way that growth patterns are established in seashells and these ideas of vortexes flowing off the wings of birds, and seeing if we could adapt that to industrial processes. And we've been fairly successful at it, working on things like fans, propellers, pumps, water mixers, and coming up with using natural principles and seeing incredible, literally exponential increases in efficiency by just using natural principles. The challenge has been, how do you create a mathematical parametric that expresses that? Now, we see a number in nature that happens. We call the golden mean. The scientific symbol for that is phi. We see that as the Fibonacci number, the Fibonacci series. Those are all number series that represent or approximate this thing that we see in nature in terms of the spins of the arms of the universe, you know, the galaxies, for example, or the or when you flush the toilet, you see that same curve, or when you look at a shell, you see that curve.
Curl of the Nautilus.
The Nautilus, yeah. Shell. Now, one of the things that has been difficult to integrate into that, because we see on the XYZ coordinate that there is repeatability, but the time coordinate, the fourth dimension, is the one that is the variability that we're having a hard time integrating into that. But you start looking at that in terms of the Nautilus shell forms over time. It's formed perfectly for its function in space and what it does in the ocean. So the forces of the ocean work with the Nautilus in a time context that create that beautiful form that we can understand so well. But if you look at the Murex shell, it's another environment, it's another shape. I mean, not everything in the universe is shaped like the Nautilus. But those numbers, those approximations start revealing themselves in all those places. If you look at the inside of our ear, the cochlea, that's the same spin, but it's not just a curve that you can draw in two dimensions. It's actually in four dimensions. So those types, that consideration has been heretofore really complex, but now that we have computer processing power that can start, you know, chewing on those numbers and working it out, we can bring forms out of that and come up with a parametric we can use to design things. And we're starting to see some really beautiful representations of this in some of the products that are falling out of the work that PAX is doing. So that's just one example. If we start looking at nature and learning her lessons, really in humility, as opposed to saying, well, we got a better way of doing this, we can actually turn this thing around.
So I'm speaking again with Michael Stalker from the Bay Area. Do you have any kind of website or organization that people could find out more about this?
Yeah, my organization, Ocean Conservation Research, is OCR.org. There's a lot of text on there, but I think the fun stuff is a whole series of sound pages. You can hear animal sounds, marine mammal sounds, fish sounds, also human-generated sounds of sonar, of air guns, and what have you, and, you know, kind of hear for yourself those differences. So that's on that side. The PAX Scientific site for biomimicry is just paxscientific.com. PAX Scientific, spelled in the usual way.
Is that an acronym for?
PAX is peace.
Oh.
It's that simple. And then in terms of really, you know, the foundation of where I feel I am right now, placed in the scheme of things, Fred Wapapa's website sevencircles.org, talks about some of the things we do. It's a fairly simple site. We have a schedule of sweats and the ceremonies on that. We also have some descriptions of the various ceremonies that we get involved in, and a little bit of discussion. But you know, hopefully that'll give a springboard to some of the things that that certainly inform my life, and hopefully keep me tied into the fabric of all of us, our relations.
So when you say you would like to, I guess, bioengineer sounds for, you know, our communication and the things that we do in the ocean, what are you kind of trying to accomplish in that arena? Are you trying to accomplish, like, radio waves mimicking the sounds of whales or the clicking of dolphins, or develop codes to that effect?
That's precisely it. I mean, if you listen, and this is something that you can see on the OCR.org website on the sounds pages, if you look at the sounds of sonar, there's some high-frequency or mid-frequency communication sonar there, frequency shift key sonars, and they're all very nasty sounds. And I don't know those of you who are familiar with the old telephone modems that we used to have fairly commonly on our computers, where you would dial up and the first couple of seconds was this very obnoxious, raspy. That is a digital communication signal, and it is obnoxious for a number of reasons. If you listen to the hunting sounds of the beluga whale, it's the same frequency band, so the same information transfer rate is possible, but it's sweet sounding. It's like music. It's really great. And if we ended up forming the sounds that we use to communicate more like the Stenella, blue dolphin vocalization, or the beluga whales, hunting vocalizations, these animals get a lot done. It's a fast baud rate, if you want to put it in digital terms, when you have a group of 15 animals doing cooperative hunting techniques to try to corner a forage fish or whatever they're feeding on. You know, they're getting a lot of information transfer pretty fast, and so we're trying to accomplish that in our crude, fairly brutal ways. If we start looking at their vocalizations and using that, we may get accomplished what we need to get accomplished without compromising the habitat. Now, the question comes up always when you do this: well, if you use those sounds, won't it confuse the beluga whales? You could say yes, but in terms of how this works in nature, what example I always use is when you see, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of bats coming out of a bat cave all at the same time, they're vocalizing in the exact same frequency band. So you might say that it would be biological masking, but they're able to determine the signals they need out of that. They can discriminate that. And the kinship here from a visual standpoint is that between the two of us, we have two pairs of eyes, two sets of eyes that are looking at things from different perspectives. We can determine, even though the light that's bouncing off this chair in front of me is hitting my eyes and your eyes at the same time, we can discriminate what we need out of that. Well, this may be the same thing with sound. So we wouldn't be confusing these animals. We'd rather be illuminating their surroundings with an acoustical daylight, if you will, that may in fact help punctuate what they're seeing better.
So, if I'm understanding you correctly, when you're talking about baud rates, you can almost assume that that's kind of an accent or a tone to the voice or a pitch to the voice that communicates emotion, but also communicates, simply communicates.
Yeah. Well, communication is an interesting word. We tend to think of communication in a, you know, human linear standpoint as conveying ideas, either with sound or with actions, from one place to another, so that it can be consumed and then responded or reacted to. But if you look at the basis, the Latin basis of the word communicate, munaris is the gift. It's so comunaris is the sharing, or the it has to do with sharing the gift, as I say in a sound standpoint, of our surroundings. So that we're participating in this conversation, both in terms of conveying ideas serially with words, but there's a lot contained in the tone of my voice. There's a lot contained in the environment with the bird that's down in the ravine here that helps us establish our surroundings. You know, we're not sitting on a freeway right now. We're in a safe environment. So we're actually sharing, we're communicating with our environment through sound. So if we start looking at communication in a broader sense as a participation or cooperation with our surroundings, instead of trying to push ideas through it, we will be communicating with it.
Well, there's any number of people who have told me that communication is not just a conveying of words, but it's the way we sit, it's the way we look, it's the way we act, it's our spiritual natures coming together, and really, that's what I'm assuming that a lot of your work is based on, is that spiritual nature, and that once you give up the id or the ego, your communication becomes that much more efficient, and that it would be that way with animals.
We learn from the animals, definitely. I think we've departed from that because we've seen, communication is something that has an origin from the individual. And, no, we're just all part of this fabric. I'm attempting to convey ideas that are, I could say are formulated in my head. But really in the best of circumstances, where the poetry really comes out and rings the environment, is where I open myself up and become a conduit for Creator. Like in the sweat lodge where the stone people are actually doing the talking. And if I don't get in the way and if I open my heart up, those stone people speak through me and let me know, and those people in my community know what's going on.
I had a medicine man once. There was like 60 rocks that were allowed for our sweats that we had requested. And he says, okay, bring those in. And I was thinking, yeah, 60 rocks, huh? That's funny, And then he brought in the 60, and it was a good red glowing pile of rocks in front of us, a good heaping mound, And then the firekeeper said, well, hey, the ladies decided not to sweat, but they have about 40 stones in there. And he goes, oh, we'll bring those in too. We've got to use those. And so he brought in the 40 stones, on top of the 60, And then he said, hey, there's a few more stones in there. He goes, yeah, like how many? There's probably like 10 or 20. He goes, well, bring those in too, because we've got to use all the stones. So there's probably a good 120 stones in there. And by the time the stones were piled up in the middle, you couldn't see the other side. You could just barely see over the pile of stones, And but at that point, the water pourer said, you might find yourself struggling, with this heat. You might find yourself fighting, The best thing for you to do is give up. Give up. You might find yourself getting angry or miscellaneous muscle movements, in fighting the heat like this. You're just going to hurt yourself. Just give up. And through that one statement that he said right there, a whole world opened up to me by being aware of that state. I was able to focus my prayer, not be affected by the heat, but also focus my songs and my drum that I do too. And that's what we all do when we pray and when we drum, is we give up our sense of self. We give up our sense of pain and ego, and then we become one with something, whatever it may be at that point. And when we do that, then we're powerful, and then that invites that spirit to come in, and same as with a community, we can give up our sense of self, and then also work for the community. And when we do that work for the community, it becomes very powerful.
That's a powerful tale, too, and the quantity of stones there is really remarkable. I think for myself, all I've been in, Luciana Perez used to just pile the stones on, and it was, it was rough, but we also knew it was going to be short, so it was short and sweet. I think probably the most challenging in terms of heat lodges that I was ever involved in, Fred took us up to a group of people from Switzerland and Norway who had come over, and they were at Lake Shastina up above Lake, Mount Shasta. And we put a lodge in, and it was a hot day, but we had one stone person, one grandpa in there, just one. There was about 30 of us in the lodge. Merciless. We didn't even have time to think about how hot it was. It was so hot. And these people who had come in, who didn't even know anything about these ways except for what was being told to them, had no choice but to surrender, because they couldn't ask that question about whether it is supposed to be this hot or whether it was traditionally this way or not. And we got a lot of work done because people naturally just did surrender. They didn't have any preconceived notions about it, perhaps, that they were able to bring into that lodge. And that one stone person, that one grandpa, spoke volumes to us all. It was very helpful.
That's a powerful prayer that went into that stone. I know the there's a direct correlation between the firekeeper and the fire and the lodge, you know, and also the person who runs the lodge. And in many cases, I think that when you do a ceremony like this, everything that is in that ceremony is preordained, you know. Like a Native American church, the way I kind of view it is there's only one ceremony throughout time, but different people filling in those positions of that ceremony, you know. And I think in many cases, the intent of the medicine person or the spiritual leader pouring the water in the sweat lodge will affect the prayer of the fire person, who also affects his own prayer and makes that relationship with the fire and puts that power into that stone.
Yeah.
So and it just speaks to the communication or the state that we all live in terms of communication with each other and this earth and this world around us and the spiritual nature of this earth. So there's any number of spiritual stories that are out there. What are some of the remarkable things that you've seen as you walk this red road, or maybe stories that you've heard?
There's so many stories out there, and I've been really blessed and honored to have been kind of tangential to some of them. These people like Luciano Perez, you know, who was a weepy man, really humble, really sweet, spoke from his heart, and didn't let that ego get in his way. I guess, you know, when I think about Luciano, I think about his smile, I think about his humility, but I also think about probably one of the most powerful Uipi ceremonies I've ever been in my life. And it was quite a number of years ago. We had a woman named Marilyn who was on our board. She had not seen her son for quite a while. He had gone off to Sudan to study Islam, and that school didn't work for him, so he ended up going up into Afghanistan to work at another school up there. And just as he was going to Afghanistan, the American military was starting to lay siege on that nation and that area up there. So she was, of course, concerned. She hadn't heard from her son in 6 months. So that was part of what this Uipi was called for. And we prayed that night deeply. It was, again, as Luciano always had, a very wonderful ceremony. And then we came out that night. The Perseid meteor shower was such that is fabulously hadn't been seen for 100 years, where everywhere, every quarter of the sky, you were seeing shooting stars just blasting across the sky, very much in the spirit of the Uipi. And when we were finished with the ceremony and everybody was tidied up, 4 days later, Marilyn's son showed up on the cover of Time magazine. John Walker. Marilyn Walker, John Walker Lind, who was called the American Taliban, who was held as a pariah to justify the Bush administration's adventures in the world to try to line the pockets of his friends. It was powerful. She was ready for it because she had just begun working in the sweat lodge and committed to start doing sun dancing. So she began her Sundance with her son. He is still now in Vacaville prison. I ask everybody to pray for him. They were nice enough to put him close enough to where his mother lives that she could visit him. And they thought that when they put him in Vacaville, because he was an evil expatriate, Taliban terrorist, that he was going to be bouncing around the walls there. But the prisoners up at Vacaville understood that they had a man who was cast as a pariah, and they treated him with respect. And he kept his prayerful ways, that he still prays to the East 5 times a day. And he does that prayer. But it was a very powerful message that I got from Creator through Luciano, that, you know, if you pray hard, those things that you need come to you. Now, Marilyn got to know her son was still alive. That was important. that other part of the prayer, you might say, I have to watch what you pray for. But Marilyn is in these ways, in a very deep way, and she's creator's informing her life. And it's a challenge that I wouldn't want to have for myself. But Marilyn's becoming a very powerful person as a consequence. And when John gets let out, I'm sure that his spirit will be very powerful as well.
The Yuipi is a ceremony that Lakotas have, but was given to them by Ojibwes, actually. As Ojibwes have a tent-shaking ceremony where the spirits come in and they have a direct relation and effect on the prayers that we do and give healings and stuff, in case anybody's wondering. Again, I'm sitting here with Michael Stocker, part of the Ocean Research
Ocean Conservation Research.
Ocean Conservation Research. And what's the website on that?
OCR.org. Uh-huh.
So check it out. There's a lot of interesting things going on with the work that he does. And he was... is that the nonprofit that... is that your own? Or is
that's my own that sponsors. Actually, I'm under fiscal sponsorship of the Ocean Foundation, but it's nonetheless a nonprofit. We do educational research work on trying to qualify. And I do also policy work on ocean noise pollution. I go to Washington, D.C. a couple times a year, rattle the halls of power, bring my noises there. And of course, the other website that is kind of the basket within which Dan and I met is his father's website, sevencircles.org. It talks about the spiritual work that we do with our community down there.
Well, at this point, I would just like to just open up this mic here for anything that you would like to express and it may possibly affect a few people and in their direction. So...
Wow, thank you. I mean, I thought I've had a great opportunity so far, but you know, when I come up here to support the Sundance, I get an opportunity to hang out here with you, Dan, and your wife Jen, and oftentimes your daughter when she's up here, and I feel really blessed by your hospitality. But most remarkably, watching your work with your organization here. Last year I was up here, and you guys were really getting the head of steam up on this thing. And I'm really impressed, proud, honored, blessed to see the work you guys are doing. That you're really taking the time to focus in this, this community circle, this fabric of community. And I think that... those folks out there listening to this, you have an opportunity to check what these folks are doing. It's really beautiful. If you have an opportunity to participate or have an opportunity to support it, put your shoulder behind it, get some work in there. It seems to me there's a lot of teaching there to be had, not just from the wisdom of the circle itself, but also from the fabric of community that's being woven together by that. The sense of inclusion and participation seems really good. So you guys are doing great work. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome. If you want to know more about that, this radio show and the events that we do is sponsored by Red Earth Descendants. And you can check our website out at redearthdescendants.org. And you could Gmail us at redearthdescendants@gmail.com. We have a Native Eco Symposium coming up, and we're hoping to get Michael Stocker as a guest speaker up there and talk about his work that he's doing with acoustic ocean research. And many other arenas that he's involved in. And I'd like to thank you for listening to us. And is there any final parting words that you'd like to express? I think we have a decent listening audience out there who have open minds and are all about community radio. So, well, thank you very much for coming up here. And we're going to go up to a ceremony today. And that's not generally open to the public, but I don't think they would turn anybody away. And if you know about it, we'll see you up there.
Ahoma Takwiasin.
I hope.